Steve Sherlock here for Franklin Matters. Franklin Public Radio, available anywhere, anytime, on the internet, in your browser, WFPR.FM, and in the local Franklin, Mass. FM radio dial. Yeah, that dial with the knobs or the push buttons. 102.9 is the number, so you can preset it. It'll always be ready for you. And we're here today virtually with Reese Hansen. Reese, good morning, and thank you for doing this.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for taking the time to do this. I'm looking forward to talking about the recent meeting and school committee.
Yes, and because I didn't put that in the intro and saying, welcome, Reese. Yes, if folks haven't re recalled or aren't aware, yes, Reese Hansen, we did talk back September-ish before the election, and then now you're an elected member of the new school committee going forward. So, how's it been? Still an early return, obviously, but.
Yeah, well, it has been a great experience so far. I want to take a moment to thank everybody who spoke with me, who took the time to get out and vote. The whole campaigning experience was a really great way to connect with people across Franklin that I hadn't had circumstance to meet before. And now that I'm on the committee and it's underway, it's been a really great experience so far. I think we have a strong committee. I think we have a good group of committed people with a healthy diversity of perspectives, a lot of mutual respect among ourselves, and a lot of, willingness to work together to get things done. And it is certainly a big difference between, sitting in the audience or watching online and sitting up at the desk and
Now you're in the seat.
exactly. Sometimes like making sure like trying to be thoughtful about questions and making sure you're communicating clearly. There's a lot of active thinking going on along with making sure you're getting all the information that's coming your way.
Right.
But it's important, and it's really an honor to be in that seat and to be there representing our town and helping guide and support the school system. It's been really rewarding.
Yeah, and I think for those who may not be aware, from my understanding, you get the packet as a preview on Friday so that you can at least prepare to the extent that you can with whatever's released in the packet for the meeting on Tuesday.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And actually, we've been getting the agenda out a little earlier even. And thank you to our chair for doing that when possible. Sometimes it comes out like there are certain packet items that don't come in until Friday,
Right.
but that extra time's been really valuable since I try to read everything in the packet and review everything in the packet before the meeting. So those couple extra days are helpful, and it also gives an opportunity for anybody who wants to send in some feedback about the agenda if there are items that we want to see on there that aren't on there.
Right.
Because once Friday rolls around, the agenda is the agenda. That we can't make changes after Friday because of
Right.
open meeting laws. So that
Sure.
window lets us get our comments in. Now, I personally haven't had any agenda changes that I've suggested myself yet, but it's been a really nice thing to be able to even just start preparing sooner and give a bit of a bigger window to read through everything.
Yeah, because I would imagine, at least based on my experience, and maybe there's a little less reading on your side. I know from the council perspective, based on the agenda I see, there can be a bunch of reading. So you may be spending some time on a weekend doing, the reading, and then, okay, what else do I, how do I feel about this? So doing some additional questioning, get some additional research in order to truly be, prepared for that, showtime on Tuesday.
That's exactly right. And one of the what I see as one of the important things to spend time on is looking through the slides of the presentations that will be coming in, and sending off any potential questions to the presenter ahead of time, because that then lets them prepare responses. And like very importantly about that is that if there is certain data that we'd like to see
Yes.
included, that's not something that someone can really come up with off the cuff. So that gives a little bit of time for the presenter to come in with that data. And sometimes it just gets incorporated into the presentation. Other times it's there and ready for us when we ask the questions. And we can't always predict all the questions we'll have, but it's certainly like we want to see this. Like giving them that heads up, it is really helpful because it facilitates the flow of information.
Yeah, and I think from my perspective so far, reporting and watching and observing, reporting on the meeting so far, I'll concur that you do have a diverse set of, seven sets of eyes. And respectfully, you're going to have different perspectives and different experiences. So something may look to you and you say, oh, what's that? And then that could trigger something else that they perhaps had not yet considered. It's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's ultimately part of our role because the presentations are generally directed at the committee, but they're there for the benefit of the community as well. And the key difference is that the committee gets to have a more active role in asking questions.
True.
So the more information that can be in the presentation, the more likely we are to answer questions the community might have.
Pre-anticipate. And then the conversation can still continue like it is today. We're doing a recap. So if people didn't catch what the 4.5 hour session that, at least they'll get some highlights here. And then, okay, this is interesting. I want to go back. So now, of course, through TV, they can go back to the video. Eventually, in a day or so, they'll be able to go back to the audio and then kind of either speed through the audio to listen or just skip ahead to the part that they really want to find out more on. What did they say? How did they say it?
Very much.
And one other piece while you're in the new committee, the committee has made some assignments around subcommittees. So there's a couple I think that you're on, one of which we want to talk a little bit more about too.
Yes, absolutely. So we've got six subcommittees, and then and those have three school committee members per subcommittee. And then there, I think, are six other roles that are taken on by individuals.
Kind of a
I
liaison role, if I recall.
exactly, yeah. So, some of them are liaison roles, and then there's also like bills review, which is not really a liaison, but is just keeping school committee eyes on the payment of bills. Payroll is
Payroll.
another thing that, and that's handled. Those two roles are handled by our chairs. I'm fortunate enough to be part of the policy subcommittee. That has been a really wonderful part of the experience. Our vice chair, and who is chair of the subcommittee, Dave Callahan, re repeatedly states that it's the best subcommittee that the school committee has, and I'm in no position to argue that claim. But that has been really great because that subcommittee is essentially responsible for establishing new policy, and it is a mix of anticipating needs, bringing it in, and discussing it. One of the things that came out of the policy subcommittee that we voted on at the last meeting, which I'll get into a bit later, but we were looking at some things about the middle school and ECDC tuition that we then came up and we voted on this past meeting. But then we also just kind of comb through the policy manual, and Al Charles put together a phenomenal spreadsheet for us that helps us actually track what items like haven't been reviewed in X amount of time. And so that's part of our process is getting them on the agenda, bringing them up, and just saying, is this good the way it is, or do we need to update it to make sure that we are as actively thoughtful as can be about the policies that we have documented for the school committee and for the schools themselves.
Yeah, and having worked in corporate life on some policy aspects, at least going back through, quote, the entire book, because it is an extensive book. But with his spreadsheet, now he can look at, okay, if this one hasn't been touched since 2012, 2011, maybe there's a good reason for it. Or maybe we no longer need it. Or maybe that because it's been forgotten, there's some significant changes need to go through that. But at least by having that kind of data approach, can give you a way to dive into the book because it is fairly massive. And I know sometimes that generally is the approach, but then DESE and/or Mass General Law changes along the way, so that obviously changes your focus. Now you need to react to this particular piece as opposed to, what else is on your agenda. But that's part of the business.
That's absolutely right. We need to make sure that our policies are aligned with state policy, and that can trigger something being added to the agenda. And occasionally, mass state policy or law will supersede what we have on our books. And a good example of that was at the book this week. We took a look at remote participation, and would you believe that since I think it was 2018 was when it was last reviewed, and our guidelines said only one member could remotely participate, and now clearly that was not the case. That was aligned with state policy when that policy was created, but obviously superseded by state policy that allowed for remote participation due to COVID. And now we no longer have those limits, and we've updated our documented policy accordingly.
And that's one in particular where folks, certainly like me, I was there before 2018, but there was one phone, speaker phone, in the administration table, and thereby one person could call in and participate remotely via the speaker phone to a meeting. That was in the days pre-COVID, of course. And then once COVID hit, we ended up going Zoom and YouTube, and the technology has enabled a whole lot more. Because now you and there during COVID, of course, there were entire virtual meetings where everybody was there, as opposed to just one person, and the first person who got it. Nobody else could.
So the other subcommittee that I'm a member of is the Horace Mann Legacy Subcommittee, and this is it's I keep using the term fun for to describe the work I'm doing, and fun is not probably not quite accurate, but it's I think it's rewarding in the same way as fun typically would be, in that it's like engaging and energizing. And I think the Horace Mann Legacy Subcommittee is has a slightly like more fun tone, because this is really about trying to find ways to honor Hor who Horace Mann was through the resources we currently have. And so Horace Mann, for those who don't know, was a Franklin native who, through his career, served in the Mass Legislature, the Massachusetts Senate. He was the first chair of the school board, and he also was in the U.S. House of Reps for some time. And during this time, he was a very strong advocate for public education, and essentially created the public education model that still persists to this day in many forms. Education looked very differently before Horace Mann stepped forward and brought his ideas to Massachusetts, which then became a model for many other US states to adopt as how they conducted their own public education. And he was also an abolitionist, which was what a lot of his time in the US Congress was spent on. So he has a very respectable and forward-thinking legacy that I think is another point of pride that we can have about Franklin's history. So what's cool about this subcommittee is that it aims to take a look at what he did and think about how can we bring this to the town in a modern way. How can we keep his keep his message alive, keep those lessons alive, and incorporate them into how we conduct our schools today. And this subcommittee, while it's got the three members from school committee, we're actually looking for 12 total members. So we're bringing on members from town council, historical commission. Gosh, there are
Some
There's one
students,
other, what's it?
if I recall.
It is students. Yes, there's one other town group that I'm drawing a blank on that we're bringing people in from. And then but yes, and then we want four just general community members at large to join us and student representatives from Franklin Middle School and Franklin High School to come join the subcommittee, all of whom will be voting members. We're not bringing people in just to talk to us and then have the three school committee members make the decisions, but really have this nice big voting panel that directs these efforts and can shape what this is going to look like. And it's going to be a mix of finding ways to like honor Horace Mann through visual things on the Horace Mann campus, which is where our high school and middle school are. There is no budget allocated to the subcommittee, but there is in the charter the ability to do some constrained fundraising. So none of the activities of the subcommittee in terms of like creating a mural or something along those lines are going to affect the operational budget. But there might be some events that raise a little bit of money so that we can commission someone to, for example, make a mural. Now, the exact nature is going to be determined by that subcommittee. And it can also take the form of events and other kind of really community engagement things to bring people together in like for informal education about Horace Mann and an advocacy on behalf of our schools. So I think it's been great to be a part of so far. I want to really encourage anybody who is interested in joining, keeping an eye out to Franklin Matters. We've got a letter that will go out there with which will explain how to get involved. And anybody who receives PCC emails, we'll also be trying to communicate through PCC letters and to generate interest, as well as the school committee's own
Newsletter.
newsletter.
Yeah. The Cultural Council was the other one that you were blanking on temporarily there, but
Thank you.
the
I appreciate you looking through while I was while I kept talking.
Yes, no. And I think it's key too as well that I mean Franklin certainly has a legacy from Horace Mann. He learned from the Franklin books in the library. That was his start of his education, which was formative to the extent that, well, I had this benefit, but nobody else did. So let's do something. And thereby, now we have the free public schools, which are generally institutionalized. But as you said, the abolitionists, I've been fortunate to read a couple of other of biographies of him, one by a formal biographer, the other one actually by his second wife. He's got a fascinating background, and there are things in there that was like, really? He did that? Oh my. So yeah, to the extent that, and I think a couple of school committee members, and I don't want to misname them, but it to truly honor his legacy from a free and public education, we need to adjust our funding practices and leveraging that as well over time, respectfully, considering the fiscal constraints we have, I think would be a good way to do so. So yeah.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that that is going to be, thinking about how we can advocate accordingly will likely be part of that the subcommittee's tasks. And I think it's wholly appropriate and helpful when I think about one of the things I was thinking about after being appointed to the committee is that intersection between abolitionism and public education, and how now, in particular, and certainly always been true, but there are certainly examples we can point to now that a strong, well-rounded education with like a strong critical thinking component is really essential to be able to separate truth from fiction right now. And even with a strong background, it can still be challenging. But we
Yes.
need to do our students I hesitate to call it a favor. We need to give them the benefit of an education that helps them understand and navigate and recognize the nature of the messages they're receiving and understand them in context to insulate them from being able to be manipulated by people who are seeking to do so.
Definitely. And we could spend more time on that. I think we'll touch on one of the topics a little bit later as it comes back to that. But getting to the meeting itself to kind of recap that, and similar to what I do for those who are familiar, although it hasn't happened just yet on the current town council, but effectively we're going to try to cover in two questions. So, okay, what just happened at the meeting? Kind of the quick highlights, and then within that, oh, what does it really mean for us as, you know, residents here, in what terms of what the school district and school department are doing? So in the superintendent's report, he took an opportunity to celebrate one of our rather successful teams.
Yes, our cheerleading team, our state champions once again. So we had the honor of bringing them in to celebrate their victory. And it was just it was very much like the volleyball team at the previous meeting. It was great to see the students that have dedicated so much time and effort into honing their athleticism to the point that they're winning these state championships, and we get to make the fairly easy decision to give permission for them to travel to Florida.
For the national level, yes.
Exactly, yes, for the national competition. And getting to getting to see the joy at getting that permission, even though I don't know that it's ever been, maybe during COVID there may have been a blip, but I don't know that it's ever been like a challenging decision to make, but certainly getting that reassurance that yes, now it's approved, now we can go forward. And one of the another committee member had mentioned in previous years, it's been part of the fun has been after the they make the vote and the cheerleading team leaves, hearing them celebrate from the parking lot. So we did hear you cheering from the parking lot during our meeting. That was a lot of fun, very appreciated. And just congratulations to the team again. We look forward to celebrating more championships with you. And best be best of luck and everything else in Florida.
For sure. Yeah, they've had a long success. I don't want to misspeak the numbers of years of things that they've been successful at, but it's quite extensive. And to the extent that it's extended so many years, clearly, as we know, you know, freshmen come in, spend 4 years, and then graduate as seniors. They've had such turnover, and yet the consistency of the performance, that speaks to the program, not just the individuals, because that entire program is successful. So it's just kudos to them for continuing that.
Yeah, absolutely. Their reputation is well earned and very obvious. Earlier, before the meeting, during the policy subcommittee, we were talking about ways to honor the championships in the town and what we could do. Thinking about things like signs off highway exits and the like that you might see sometimes where it's like home of the whatever ch champions. And a comment made as we were exploring options during that discussion was that, for the cheerleading team, we'll probably need a bigger sign very quickly. So we need to be thoughtful about future growth in that way.
Well, and that's where the digital display would help too, because then you could just kind of scroll through each of their years.
Indeed. So that, those considerations are still underway about what exactly we'll be doing in that regard. But I'm looking forward to making a plan to get some kind of display to honor them and all the other champions that we have here in Franklin.
So then you had a fairly different, but another request for a trip for high school students in 2027 to go to a place that, ooh, I want to go too.
Yeah. So. One of the high school teachers, and I mean, Jay Chetlin is his name. He's been teaching math at Franklin High for 25 years now, and he's done two so far. This is his third
This would be his
tour.
third, yeah.
with a group called EF, which I believe stands for Education First.
Education first, yep.
It is, that's correct. Okay. And this year he wants to take them to Quito, Ecuador, and then travel on to the Galapagos Islands, where they will be getting a chance, an opportunity to see the wildlife there, to see the finches that Charles Darwin wrote about so long ago. And he gave a brief 15 slide presentation, just kind of an overview of what EF is, the safety measurements that they take, and the costs for students, and how that is all handled, and different options to try to make it more affordable for some of the students. It's open to freshmen through juniors. Anybody who is currently a high school student and will also be a high school student next year, because this trip is in February 2027, is eligible to apply. The pictures that he shared to kind of give a sense of what the students would be seeing in Quito and on the islands are vibrant and beautiful, and of course with the tortoise being the kind of centerpiece of how we conceive of the Galapagos Islands. And so it was great to be able to approve this. It is the cost is mostly borne by the students who are attending, but fortunately, because this is his third trip with EF, they were able the school was able to convert some, I think they called it points, but essentially like accrued credits, into funding that can be used to for students who are otherwise eligible to go, but cost would be a barrier. And so I believe they're still determining exactly how those funds would be used and allocated, but certainly it was great to be able to approve his request to take these students next year. And I'm just so glad that Franklin gives students the opportunity to do some travel, both domestically and worldwide, to places that are not always things that people would think of going. I don't know how many people say, let's take a family vacation to the Galapagos Islands, but there is such a rich experience to be had there. So I look forward to, I mean, it won't be till probably March 2027 or so, but I look forward to hearing about the experience once the trip has taken place.
That's one of the things that I think they'll have to institute or institutionalize as part of. Okay, they got the approval, which then gives them the opportunity to do their info sessions, do the sign-ups, work through the family, fundraising. Clearly, your approval now because the trip's next year, so it allows for fundraising in the meantime, because not everybody's going to have that fund available readily to just go. But then, sometime appropriate, whether it's 3 months, 4 months, whatever, come back and give a brief update in terms of this is what we did, this is how we did it, and we had fun. We'll go again. And then you had a lengthy presentation from the program of studies being proposed for some minor modifications at the high school.
Yeah, so this presentation gave us an overview of how the program of studies is reviewed and updated, and then gave us information about like specific changes that have been made. And there were four major adjustments made this year. One, which is I think really exciting, is innovation career pathways are now part of the high school. There's two DESE-approved innovation career pathways, and these are in the realms of business and finance and health and social assistance. And essentially, to my understanding of how these work, is that a student would go to their guidance counselor, say they are interested, and their course load would be adjusted accordingly to orient themselves towards business and finance, towards health and social assistance, and have some additional courses that compose that innovation career pathways alongside a segment that is real world experience th through internship and capstone projects of sorts and like. And this is similar to models used in other countries and certainly other schools around around the US, and as also a very similar model to what you might see in schools that are specifically tech schools, that where students are enrolling in a specific shop that they get experience at building skills in that area. So we're able to offer these two now. So that's exciting, great, and look forward to hearing how these two pathways play out for the students who enroll, and looking forward to developing more pathways should this program prove to be successful. And I personally, I'd be surprised if it weren't. I would think that at high school, the students are usually beginning to think about what they want to do through their lives career-wise. And for those who maybe are not there, the presence of the innovation career pathways might spark that interest. Especially because it doesn't, you're not committed to anything. It's not like enrolling, like declaring a major in college or enrolling in a master's program. But it gives more targeted experience that would hopefully also give the students a leg up in getting to those college programs, those master's
Or at
programs.
least getting the toes in the water, respectfully, wet enough to find out whether they truly, really do want to do that. Or if they find out, oh, that's what it takes, I don't think I want that, which is equally valuable.
It certainly is. I appreciate you bringing up that component, that being able to rule something out as a potential career pathway for yourself, because it's not, you learn it's not what you want. That is, it's an important thing to do. And some people, when you find that out later in your career, it's a harder thing to make a change to. So it's a great opportunity.
Definitely.
We've also got new course proposals coming to the high school. There are, let me count real quick, eight, nine new courses being added to the course catalog at the high school. When courses are added, it is not it does not encumber new expenditures. It is simply they're offered, and the courses that actually take place are determined by student interest, as Dr. Weber clarified. And there's some really creative and interesting courses being added. There we chatted a bit about one being added called Learn to Jam, which is about people who are kind of dipping their toes into musicianship and bringing them together with other students and learning some basic music theory and improvisation skills that would allow them to play with others. And as personally, I am I do not have the level of expertise or musicianship that I would like to have, but I certainly enjoy playing it, and that kind of, I find so much benefit from that kind of experience, of being vulnerable and learning to trust others and create something expressive while kind of also just relying on skills you've built through practice and relying on your fellow musicians to support one another. It is a really great experience with which I think develops skills that are transferable and maybe kind of loosely or indirectly, but that flexible kind of thinking and the ability to adapt and the ability to be okay making a very public mistake. As someone who's currently dabbling in drumming, I'm very aware of how my mistakes affect my fellow
They
musician.
become visible, don't they?
Oh my goodness, yes. And just being able to gain comfort with that and being okay with that, that is so easily transferable to comfort in a job interview, making a professional presentation, and so forth. Another really interesting change that they've made is that with Latin becoming less popular, but still having presence in the world, they've adapted the Latin courses to now offer more specified Latin education, which would be in the realm of medicine or the realm of legal terminology, because those are two places where Latin is still very much present and alive. And I think it's a great idea. As someone who took Latin in high school and college, I found it really interesting. I find ways to still apply it today. But in the class, we were talking about like the girl gives the spear to the boy, and we're not, that's not really relevant to modern life. And so while I'm still grateful for that education, this is much more directed towards modern relevancy. And I think that's a really great way to continue offering Latin education in ways that more holistically can benefit our students.
Yeah, and I like the intentional potential tie to both of the pathways because potentially, from legal terms, that tends to fit into the business and finance space. And from medical terms, that fits into the medical and care in it pathway. So those are, not necessarily full year length courses. I think they mentioned either whether it was a semester or a trimester or whatever, but those are still key building blocks to helping perform or form that, professional student entering the real life eventually.
Yeah, they absolutely are. And I think a couple other examples of the creative thought going into these courses would be social studies is now offering an American history through sports course, which immediately resonated with me because my own experience with historical education was that it was dry and it was my least favorite class. And it wasn't until I took the last mandatory history course I ever had, which was Gen Ed in undergrad. And the professor in that course did not, we weren't reading from textbooks. He got up in front of the class and told a story. And what we were reading in between the classes were primary documents and
Ah,
journals. And it brought history to life. So my hope is that American history through sports is going to grab onto something that students may have more interest in, and then use that to tell those stories that bring history to life and teach those lessons. And the other, it also connected to sports, is that phys ed is now going to be offering a course called Ref Reps, which is going to provide referee training to students. And once they've completed, they will be eligible for certification to serve as referees in any sub varsity level competition. And so not only is that finding a new, different way to provide physical education, to get students involved in sports, to provide a means of involvement for students who are passionate about a sport but might have other barriers to being able to directly participate. And also some opportunities for students to make a little bit of money and get a job as a referee afterwards.
Absolutely. And if you truly like it and then continue to develop, you could be refereeing a Super Bowl game at some point. Who knows?
Absolutely. So, and my highlighting these courses, there are some other new ones. I'm certainly not meaning to suggest that these are better or otherwise than the other new ones, but they stood out as particularly different than what you might usually expect to see in a high school course catalog. So I wanted to take a moment to highlight those.
Yeah, and I'll just reemphasize what you mentioned before since we're closing this particular topic, but not to lose the point. But while they're new courses, they're not net new personnel requirements. They're already within the skills and resources of the existing teaching staff. And it still depends upon the students to vote to say there's enough interest. So I think Dr. Weber mentioned that there's not more than 10 to 15. Then the class unfortunately can't be run generally because of resource requirements. So,
Yes, absolutely. So hopefully there's plenty of interest in courses.
Sure. And then you got into an even more detailed presentation from the teaching and learning. And while in prior years, this would have been kind of the MCAS update, but to the extent that MCAS is no longer a requirement for high school graduation, it's still an element of a sort of competency measure, at least, in addition to other measures that they eventually alluded through in the lengthy presentation. And I would encourage folks, at least I will definitely pull that out so it'll be a separate audio piece to listen to. And I think there was 40 something slides. Fortunately, I at least have the pictures. I haven't seen the actual slides come up on the page yet, but once they're up on the page, I'll share that as well. Because there's an awful lot of detail, and however long we take here, I'm sure we're going to do it some justice, but enough to say, go take a deeper dive, because there's a lot of goodness there.
Yes, it was a lengthy presentation, 40 something slides. Fortunately, they structured it in a helpful way where they kind of had two parts and took time for questions in between each. So the first part was an overview of like who the Office of Teaching and Learning is and how it's structured and essentially how like their perspective and viewpoint of how they how they enact their policies and their goals and how they support our school system. In this section, other that aside from introducing themselves and the main presenters we had there were Dr. Rogers, who's present at every school committee meeting, and also brought in Ms. Lizzie Morrison, who's the Director of Curriculum Humanities, and Mr. Eric Stark, who's the Director of Curriculum STEM, to support the presentation. And they kind of they described it as the system as being an engine of sorts, where there's fuel, which is the targeted professional development, learning and collaboration, the engine being instructional leadership teams or ILTs, that disseminate that information, that provide training to our teachers, and then finally from that the extraction of data to see are these methods getting the results that we want, and that data it was covered in the second part of the presentation. And I'm not going to represent the entire thing, but I think some really key components that are worth sharing here are that like the framework they work within is called UDL or Universal Design for Learning, which is kind of takes the perspective that if at the forefront the education is designed in a way that can be accessible to the most number of people, then that reduces the chance of needing to go back and adapt for specific audiences. And of course, in that, while it's, there's work that needs to be done, but really, I think the bigger thing is the missed opportunity there, where a student spent time trying to learn something that wasn't designed for them, and then more effort is needed on both the teaching and student side to help that student understand. There's a great graphic in the
I'm
presentation,
glad you
which,
mentioned that. Yes, that was a key graphic in my point of view too.
yes, where it's showing, in terms of accessibility, just a simple doorway with a wooden ramp leading up to it. It's very clear that this ramp replaced stairs that used to be there, and certainly it's made the building accessible, but there's a story there of how it wasn't always that way, and they had to go back and correct. And then there's this magnificent staircase that as the other visual, which I've not seen anything like this in person before, and I look forward to encountering one in real life. But it is a pretty big staircase, but built into it going left to right, like a kind of winding ski slope or a road that you might see
Kind of
going up a
switchback type.
mountain. Exactly.
Yes.
Is a ramp built directly into the stairs. So this same staircase services people who are ambulatory and easily able to access the stairs, but also There's that ramp built right in, so there's not any additional accommodation needed for people who do need, whether it's a less of an incline or who are on wheels and obviously can't climb stairs with those wheels. And it's just a great illustration of the mindset that comes into to how they design the education. And then the other side of that is the multi-tiered system of support, and this was something that was also covered in Paul Morano's presentation on special ed back in December. But this is essentially the idea that there is universal support, which is considered tier one. These are supports provided to all students. There's no specific plans needed for students to access those supports. Tier two is targeted support. These are specific supports afforded to students who have particular challenges or barriers in accessing the material. And so those specific students receive those supports. They're not universal either because of, the additional cost or personnel needed, or just that, they're for students that don't need it, those additional supports may actually slow down the learning for those other students. And then tier three would be intensive support. And th this is these are this is when student need rises to the level of perhaps needing to be outside the district or needing to be in a specifically targeted program within the district. And so between UDL and MTSS, there's a really holistic approach to meeting student needs in that way. And it's been I think it was a great presentation. I encourage people to go back and check it out if you have some time. Part two, as I mentioned, covered data collection and how that data is used. And there's a few primary forms of data collection for K through two. Our district uses an assessment protocol called iReady, and that highlights whether students are like where we expect them to be, one grade level below, which students are expected to be one grade level below when they're starting a new grade. But
Especially at the beginning of the year, for sure.
Exactly. So it's going to flag students as one grade level below early on, but that's appropriate. That's how we measure outcomes. That's how we measure the progress. And then it also will flag students that are two grade levels below, and that's generally a sign for students that need additional support. And because these outcomes are flexible, that as the year progresses, we expect students to move from that one grade level below to on grade level or above grade level. And later in the year, if we see that's not happening, then that flag can also be used as an indicator that that student might need some additional support, and get the give an opportunity to provide that as soon as we recognize the need. After third grade, the measurement changes, of course, to MCAS. MCAS is something we need to do anyway, creates a lot of data, and that's the measurement that's used in elementary three through five. Through middle school, I believe as well.
Because that eighth grade still takes it, and then it used to be the 10th grade MCAS was kind of the gateway. You got a potential door open to graduate if you passed the MCAS in 10th grade, but clearly that's no longer a grad requirement, but it's still a measure as to making sufficient progress.
Yes, absolutely. So apart from the measurements that we're using, it was really helpful to get a sense of how the data we collect within Franklin is then used to gauge how we're doing. And our presenters described what DART is, and I'm sorry, I'm scrolling to find what that acronym actually stands for. Here it is, district analysis. Oh, district analysis and review tool. And this is a DESE tool. But what DESE does, and that's the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, They group schools together and say, here are the schools that your district is comparable to. So, and that can be based on, I think generally is based on population.
School population, at least, yes.
Yeah, and I think there's some accounting for resources within there. But the presenters also told us that while DART is a great place to start, it's not the only way that they compare our schools to others. So
Correct.
they're not only looking at what DESE says is here are the comparable schools, but also schools across the district, schools that are using similar programs to those we are, schools whose funding is aligned or not aligned with ours. And they shared the, the measurements that they took here in terms of how they compare to those other DART schools. And it's really phenomenal to see that we are in the top, the in terms of the 11 we're compared to, fourth is the lowest that we ranked in those measurements. And generally we are number one or number two in a lot of these measurements. Also, very consistently, when comparing our outcomes to state outcomes, we are above the state averages.
Correct.
And so that was really excellent to see. One place in which we are not favorably compared to the other DART schools is in per student funding. I think we are currently ninth of 11th, if I recall
Yeah, we
correctly.
were in that bottom third at least.
And so I think the outcomes that we're seeing is really a testament to the strength of our teaching staff, to the strength of the educational approach described in this presentation. But I think it is also a warning sign that if funding keeps falling, then these phenomenal teachers we have are going to become more easily recruited by other districts. And we want to retain these teachers because they're not just their passion for our community and their teaching skills, but that kind of tenure is so valuable in maintaining a healthy school district where new teachers come in to meet people who inspire their own teaching methodology and who have that knowledge that can be passed along, and opportunities for in-district training, which, a stipend to a presenter that can reach, tens, if not hundreds, of other teachers is a much more efficient investment than sending individual teachers to trainings hosted in other districts or by other agencies, in which case we, are paying per teacher that receives that knowledge. Another highlight, I know people will say, like, the school committee keeps talking about the budget, keeps talking about funding. And as a new member of school committee who is now talking about budget and talking about funding, there's a reason for that. And I know this is about school committee, but I encourage everyone to also go watch the finance committee meetings, particularly the one this week covered our town's finances in relation to schools, but also the town as a whole. And it's really, really important information for anybody who lives in Franklin, who cares about Franklin, anyone who believes Franklin matters. It's important information for them to have.
Thank you for that segue. Nice one, Ness. Which also gives us a good segue because, well, retention also was sort of covered in the next item in regards to the childcare debt, and also a revenue opportunity. It won't be the silver bullet to help us, but it will be some additional revenue to reinforce and hopefully maintain while still providing educational opportunities. Retain employees who have kids who do need childcare, whether on the school or town side, and then maybe in the future, ultimately opening it to the community. But let's walk or crawl, walk, then run. So we're still in the crawling, establishing phase at this point.
We are, but I really appreciate that about the approach that they're taking here, because it is avoiding an overcommitment if there are, if we learn about changes that need to be made, or well, I would be very surprised if this was the case, but if the program is not as popular as we anticipate it might be, then it prevents, over commitment in that way. So this presentation was made by Patty Gay, who is the head of the Lifelong Learning Institute here in Franklin. I think they are probably most well known as the people who run Solutions, the after school program, but they also do a whole lot of other stuff for our communities, in terms of like extended educational opportunities in music and the arts, summer camps. There's a whole lot of great work that they do.
And
My
all
own kid.
self-funded by fees, which is very important.
Yes. My own child is in their Glee program right now, and they're having
Oh,
their
cool.
concert next week. I'm very excited to see that. But yes, and that I think, on the topic of budget, that is really one of the key aspects of this is that the childcare program is intended to start with, essentially one room, two professionals caring for nine students, and that's the mandated ratio for the age range there. And my link's not working to the presentation right now. If I remember correctly, the age range that they'll cover is 18 to 33 months.
That's my recollection, yeah. So it kind of fit into that gap before the formal ECDC early childhood education program started, which also gives us a natural segue growth path to go back to a pathway concept. So we'd be providing the educational space, i.e., daycare, childcare for those early youth. And then potentially they could segue right into the 3-year program, then the 4-year program, and then ultimately into kindergarten.
That's it. That's exactly right. At the outset, this program is intended to provide care for children of Franklin Public School teachers. And there is a risk of losing teachers when kids are born because it is very expensive to get that kind of child care. And apart from that, parents want to be the ones providing that child care. And so this program would really fit with the school day that could provide a way for teachers to continue teaching and have reliable, local, easily accessible childcare with people that they can trust here in Franklin. With longer term plans, though, to expand access to potentially other town employees in other departments and just the town as a whole in general. And create a new option for childcare here in Franklin. And as you mentioned, Steve, this is designed from the outset to be entirely self-funding. So it should not impact our budgets. And beyond that, if the program is popular, is developed further, potential revenue opportunities where revenue from the child care program may be able to be allocated to other opportunities within lifelong learning or Franklin as a whole. So I think it's a really exciting initiative. I'm really looking forward to seeing how everything plays out. It's meant it, you know the intention is for this to be available to teachers next year. And for any teachers who might be listening at the meeting at this time, the intention is to provide these nine slots on a first come first serve basis. So keep an eye out for when that starts and reach out and sign up as soon as you can. Anyone who is familiar with trying to sign their student up for Solutions after school, understand how quickly these slots can get filled.
Definitely. So I think that covers the kind of the key presentations, but there was also a key citizens comment that I think we want to talk about too.
Yes, there was. And actually before we go on to that, Steve, I did want to just touch upon a couple things that we voted to approve, one of
Oh,
which is
sure.
connected with Franklin Childcare. Which is that we voted to approve a lower tuition rate for ECDC the upcoming year. So any parents out there who are considering ECDC, but maybe cost was pr prohibitive for them, take another look, because this year the tuition rate is lowered. To those who are hearing me say this and are concerned, saying, "What about the budget?" This should also help balance the budget, because there's that balance between tuition rate and enrollment. And when enrollment goes down, it doesn't matter that tuition's high. We're going to have more revenue, and the program will be more self-sufficient with a higher enrollment rate, even if the tuition is lower. Furthermore, from my perspective, I think the reason the program exists is to serve the needs of Franklin residents in the first place. And if the tuition is so high that it's non-competitive, then it's not meeting its intended goal in the first place. So I think this was a really great change. And the other thing I wanted to mention that we approved is that that goes along with the high school pathways, is that we're creating policy to help expose middle school students to those eventual pathways so they can know heading into high school from the outset that this is an option. And we had the first reading of that policy. It's not entirely approved yet, but that's the first of second votes that will eventually get it approved.
Yeah, I think that's also tapping into the coincidence now. And one of the other benefits of the redistricting with all the middle school now conveniently located next to the high school. Some of those coordinations and bridge building and awareness things will just be that much easier. And now you're actually making it by policy, more or less forcing the requirement to happen, not just waiting for the, lightning to strike.
Absolutely. So then, to bring us back to the citizen comment you mentioned, and I agree. I want to say this: the meeting we had with the presentations, this community member stayed with us in council chambers until I think it was maybe 11:15 when
Thereabouts, yeah.
she was able to get up and share her comment. And this is Dr. Carolyn Cunnell, who you've spoken with on other Franklin Matters programming, who is a neuropsychologist here in Franklin. And she spoke about concern about the impact of screen time on our students, and especially the presence of screens in the classroom, and had a very a very thoughtful comment about urging us to take a look at how our district is using technology and think about how we can modify that to reduce our reliance on technology in the classroom, because of all of the negative effects that she mentioned. Things along the lines of emotional regulation and attention span are affected. That kind of stimulation seeking behavior can be exacerbated when learning is done on screens. And beyond that, that reading, like, information retention is stronger when reading off of paper compared to reading off of a screen.
And writing versus typing.
Exactly. That is another comparison she's made. And
Yes.
for anybody who's questioning it, I encourage you to even just try it out on yourself. I know personally, I noticed this to be true of myself, and I have developed a real strong preference to take notes on paper instead of on a computer. And you may notice, if you're in the chambers, like when I'm in meetings, I've got the computer open because that's where the presentations are and the reference documents are. But I've also got a notepad to my right, and I'm taking notes over there, because it is, I mean, I find it not only more helpful, but even in some ways more efficient. Certainly I can't write a paper as quickly as I can type a paper, but when it comes to kind of juggling tabs and whatnot, it's nice to just have the notes where the notes are and not have to be tabbing around.
No.
And I think what was really helpful about hearing this citizen comment is that, I from my perspective, in my role on school committee is to be a representative for the community as a whole. And while part of that is feeling like, well, I was elected because of some of the perspectives I have, and so my personal beliefs do play some kind of role in the policy and topics that I want to draw attention to, I don't look at it as my opportunity to shape things the way I want them to be shaped, because it really is a community effort. So hearing from people like Dr. Kunell, and you know, that not only is her research helpful to me in terms of developing my own understanding of these topics, it is a reminder that I'm not alone in thinking about this. I, like, other people care about it. And the response from the committee as a whole shows that the committee as a whole is thinking about it. And I think this her comment has likely sparked further discussions among ourselves about how you know, about steps we can take. I think it is very likely we'll see technology related topics surfacing on upcoming policy agendas in terms of the policy subcommittee. And I think it is something that I've heard from other community members as well in personal conversations. And I want to encourage other community members to use that citizens' comments as an opportunity to share their thoughts with us. Now, I recognize, like, there is a lot of commitment that went into making that comment because it happened to coincide with a very lengthy meeting. Fortunately, not all of our meetings are that lengthy. There are opportunities to comment remotely if you can sign in to, I think you need to sign in through Zoom to be
Through
able
the
to make that comment.
Zoom webinar, provide your email and name, then at the time you raise your hand in the citizens' comment, then they can unmute you so that you can make the comment.
Yeah, and for those for whom that would even be a barrier, send emails to us on school committee. We do read them all. We you it is sometimes you will not get responses from it is in fact unlikely you will get responses from every committee member. Part of that is you know, we need to be mindful of our communications in terms of open meeting laws. And so, you know, there are not often going to be like group discussions held over email. And typically we default to letting the chair handle the emails that are sent to the committee at large, but trust that we all see them and we all think about them. And when appropriate, we bring them up for discussion in future meetings. So I want to thank Dr. Grinnell. I want to thank the other community members who have sent those emails for us to think about and address. And you know, there are agenda items that come out of that. We are doing our best to listen to represent the community. And the more people that share their support, and to those listening to this, if you heard Dr. Grinnell's comments and you agree with what she's saying, send an email that just says that, because that more and more reassures us that we are acting on behalf of our community in the way that the community wants us to act on their behalf.
I agree, and I think based on my original conversation with her and her colleague, we've committed, and she's agreed to at least a future podcast, because I think to foster that kind of thoughtful reflection and discussion, granted, the Chromebooks have a specific place in some of the delivery of the technology, particularly the MCAS and other testing devices, but they don't necessarily need to be used for the entire day. And I think that's what we're trying to better understand. And clearly, we're not the educational experts, the teachers and the educational professionals are. But knowing what she's bringing to the table in terms of the implications of that, right? The attention, the scrolling, and all that other kind of stuff. Let's have that discussion. And yeah, who knows what the future holds, but as long as the discussion is held, then we'll get there, I think.
I absolutely agree. And I'm looking forward to being part of that discussion. I kind of looping this all the way back to the beginning. I'm also serving as liaison to the School Wellness Advisory Council, which kind of focuses on physical health and nutrition goals related to the school community, as well as serving as the liaison for the Mental Health and Well-being Task Force. And I think these topics of technology in the classroom, technology in our lives, are relevant to both of those councils' task forces accordingly. And so, I think there will probably be discussions in both of those places as well, in addition to policy, in addition to the school committee as a whole.
Good. Well, thank you for taking the time. This was a little bit more extensive recap, but I think because of the length and the nature and the four key presentations, we couldn't really have cutting it shorter. Well, we did cut it shorter than the 4 hours of the meeting, so.
Yes. Yeah, I appreciate the chance. And while this might be a longer than typical ch chalkboard chat, maybe that's just appropriate for a longer than typical school committee meeting.
Yeah, I think that's a
The
fair way to say
meeting.
it. Yes. Yeah. We did justice to it, and they can still go for the deeper dive into the meetings itself. Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. Well, thank you again for doing this. To the listeners, thank you for listening. The show notes will include links to the school committee YouTube page for the video, et cetera. The presentations, as those are posted, we'll make sure those are up there. I know I captured some screenshots, so there's a photo album for most of the presentations. I think I have to go back to the Galapagos one. I know I took pictures, but I don't think that album's up there yet. So I discovered that along the way. So I'll get that up there. But thank you both for doing this, the listeners in general, and you for doing it. And a quick reminder, we do this because Franklin matters.